Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative cancer care charity, supporting people with cancer in learning about and accessing the broadest range of choices in cancer care. My guest on the show this week has a title that we in the UK are unfamiliar with. Heidi Kussmann is a naturopathic oncologist. It certainly sounds like the kind of person I'd want to consult if I had cancer. In order to find out more, I'm talking to Heidi in the United Arab Emirates over the internet. Hello, Heidi. A big welcome to the Yes Life Show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So it's always great to host a new guest for the first time on the show. You're speaking to us from the Middle East today, but actually you're a long way from your home country. For listeners who don't know you, would you like to tell us something about your background and how and why you've arrived in the Middle East?
Okay, sure. Yeah, my background is one whereby I have, started in oncology years and years and years ago. And from there, it started, I fell into a treatment bucket. I was in an area practicing in Canada where I graduated in 2002 that had a high cancer incidence because of high levels of tobacco farms. There was a lot of tobacco farming in the area. Now, it had since been turned into other types of farming, and there were fewer tobacco farms, but the end result was we had a bunch of farmers with cancer because for various reasons and theories, it could be the pesticides on the tobacco, it could be that they smoke, their own personal history and health, whatever it might have been. And so in treating one farmer for the side effects from chemotherapy, I wasn't doing anything other than alleviating nausea, you know, the usual gamut of side effects. I wasn't even thinking of specializing at the time. I was in general family medicine. I was just trying to help out. And then another farmer came in, another farmer, and I sort of fell into this bucket because they all worked in a sort of a group, and that they referred to each other when something worked. And so being farmers, you're quite resourceful that way. And so I ended up starting treating farmers with different types of cancers. And the end result was I got my board certification about 5 years later, and then I was recruited to work from Canada to work in Tulsa for Cancer Treatment Centers of America. And so I moved to the USA in 2010, met my husband, and then I had taken a break to have our daughter, and his work moved us to Tulsa to Anchorage for a couple of years, and then Anchorage to Houston, and then his work moved us again to Abu Dhabi. And while we were in Houston, of course, during the pandemic, we decided that it probably would work best if I did some telemedicine instead of clinical practice, just for shielding risks and that sort of thing. And it sort of took off because I started doing it in 2019 before the pandemic. And then it really got hold when people were at home. And it very much suited my oncology patients because they didn't, nobody wanted to get COVID, but they were already immune suppressed and they were already dealing with fatigue. And I think that the commute around Houston is not fun for anyone, and never mind parking, and that you might need someone to drive you. And so the burden of just getting to appointments was high for someone who didn't really have all the energy and resources to get there. And so telemedicine was a natural solution for it. And coming to Abu Dhabi, I've just continued it, albeit with some time zone changes.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing. So you are kind of pandemic ready, having switched to telemedicine already.
Again, yeah, the timing was something where, I wish the pandemic didn't happen. But
sure, but
it certainly helped to be telemedicine ready when that did happen.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, so you describe yourself as a naturopathic oncologist. That's not a title that's familiar here in the UK. No such thing. In fact, even naturopathy doesn't get spoken about that much. We got like nutritional therapists, functional medicine practitioners, plenty, but not so many people describe themselves as a naturopath. So can you tell us what distinguishes a naturopath and what it takes to become one? And then importantly, what is a naturopathic oncologist?
Okay, so let's start with the education piece, in that if you're going to pursue naturopathic medicine as a career, as a profession, you need to go to a professional school, which is a four-year postgraduate degree. At the time when I went, there was one in Toronto. And then as a prerequisite to that degree, you needed to have either an undergraduate science degree or a pre-medicine degree. There's different universities in Canada that offer you a pre-med degree or a science degree. I have a science degree from the University of Victoria. And then I went to the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine for 4 years to get the actual naturopathic training. The curriculum is the same as regular medicine. You have the same ologies and pathology and diagnostic labs and differential diagnoses, anatomy, dissection, all of that is the same. Then you get the additional learning of nutrition, homeopathy, acupuncture, Chinese medicine, Asian herbal medicine, Oriental medicine, depending on what the jargon is these days for that, I'm not sure. And then from there was added like orthopedic assessment, that sort of thing, having to do with being able to refer, essentially, to know when something needs an orthopedic referral as opposed to other things like physiotherapy. So that completed our training over the course of 4 years. So they were long days, and just like regular med school, second year was your readout year, and you had a lot of work. It was a big commitment.
Interesting, because it's, I mean, people think of medical training as demanding, but this is sort of medical training plus, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And so when you graduate, you start practice. There is no residency type programming or matching process for naturopathic medicine. But since I've graduated, there is. So you can go into specialties now and residency programs for those specialties. So the infrastructure of the profession is growing as a result. So when I graduated back in 2002, it's been 20 years, there were about maybe 1,500 naturopathic doctors in Canada. And that population in Canada at the time was about 27 million, you know, like it wasn't a lot. And it's grown since then. There's another school in Vancouver, and there's more schools in the USA, and, you know, states and provinces continue to be licensed. Then from the regular training, you can do now residency programs, like I was saying. So you can do endocrinology residency, pediatric residency, oncology residency, or oncology proof of training. And then you go through your certification process from there with an accredited body. Mine is with the American Board of Naturopathic Oncology. And it's a 10-year certification of that specialty that I renewed in 2020.
Right. Amazing. So this route whereby you essentially go through standard medical training and then add on naturopathy afterwards or alongside it anyway, I assume that it's given the status of naturopaths a quite considerable boost as opposed to, you can train obviously in similar things here in the UK, but you don't have to be medically trained to do that. And so lots of people are just trained, even though it's a very demanding course. A nutrition course can be 4 years, but nonetheless, yeah. It's not terribly well respected here. But I assume that having the medical training does sort of add to your sort of clout as a practitioner. Is that true?
Yeah, it helps the conversation. Yes. In that when you're speaking with peers and you're writing referral letters, well, or emails for our current times, and just simply patient communication and record keeping, you're speaking the same language. Mm. And so that's an important part of being able to speak in terms of diagnosis and prognosis in oncology. The other part to oncology is being able to understand risks and hazard ratios and the literature that is produced as a result of all the studies being done. Mm-hmm. The main term that I'm mostly concerned with in oncology is overall survival, or progression-free survival to a lesser extent, but overall survival is really what trumps any other type of literature search and conversation, in that if you have, in the research, there's a lot of drugs being approved, and we'll talk about some of them in terms of checkpoint inhibitors, but in some people where immunotherapy provides a good match, there's good results, but in other people where it does not, it gives an overall progression-free survival about 2 months. And so what that means is someone doesn't actually survive at all. They just live longer by 2 months before the therapy stops working. Mm-hmm. And so there's that sort of language to be able to discuss it with your peers, whether you're an oncologist, a radiologist, or a surgeon, or a naturopathic oncologist, a nurse oncologist. Those are the language terms that are important to define how we make decisions in our clinical care.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds, you know, like it's a good thing for the whole status of integrative medicine to me.
Yeah.
I mean, we in this country, we have people who are doctors who then go on to train in nutrition or in functional medicine or something. And there's an increasing number of those. And that is obviously helping a lot in that way. But up until quite recently, that was quite unusual. And it was nearly, you know, anyone who's a nutritionist was just a nutritionist. And that was that.
And I think that some doctors, and I respect them for this, some of them are realizing that the actual lifestyle of practicing medicine and residency, all of that, you know, you arrive after residency already burnt out, your adrenals are exhausted, and it's not a healthy way to start your profession. And so, you know, there's been a demand for sort of a mindset change. Medicine doesn't need to be military school or military training per se. And I know a lot of that came from the College of Surgeons, you know, because they were army trained physicians and surgeons back, it goes back to war dates and that sort of thing. And so when you look at medical training now, it has, in a way, the mindset has become demilitarized and more humanized, which I think is a welcome change for the profession. It'll make us better doctors.
Mm, absolutely. It's interesting what you just said. I mean, I often mentally tie up the way that healthcare is run with the army. That's the nearest thing you can think to, really, about the structure and the general way it's run. And so, but I hadn't actually made the connection to the fact that, of course, that's where a lot of it started, is chopping bits off people in the war. So, you know, you can sort of see the heritage there, but definitely needs demilitarizing. I'm right behind that. Okay, so today we're going to be speaking about an enormously important topic, strategies to prevent recurrence of cancer. So if there's one scenario that's far, far too common here in the UK, it's that one of someone receiving standard treatment for cancer, being given the all clear, going home to get on with their life, and then 6 or 9 months later, they're back again, diagnosed with a recurrence. This time it's got secondaries, it's untreatable. So this is an area where I'd say that integrative medicine has some of its greatest strengths. So it's great to be exploring it today. My first question is about who should be thinking about these sort of strategies and when.
So if I can draw a timeline for you across the screen from like a lifespan, say from the birth to the death point of an individual, as soon as we're born, we're in sort of a pre-cancer survivorship stage. And that, I would say, we're not to be pessimistic, but we have cells that are changing and the immune system is catching them. And they could be precancerous cells or unchecked growth, whatever it might be. And then when we actually receive a diagnosis, you know, we're still in survivorship. We're in survivorship all the way through, but the sort of pre-cancer and initial stage of cancer diagnosis, the prevention part before diagnosis is important. If you know you have family history or genetic things that show up as a greater predisposition towards developing a cancer, that's where someone would focus their efforts on prevention, in that early stage pre-diagnosis phase. For example, if you had BRCA1 and 2 genetic positive mutations, then you would be working actively to reduce all forms of activation of those mutations, including removing the receptor sites, which includes often ovarectomy, hysterectomy, mastectomy, those estrogen receptor sites. But you also work to eliminate it in terms of exposure, so your environment and that sort of thing. If you were diagnosed with colon or colorectal cancer and it turned out to be a genetic, if you have something like that where you're diagnosed early, or you know in your family colon cancer is a part of your family history, testing usually starts 10 years before the norm. In the US, in North America, it's at age 45 for your initial colonoscopy screening, but if you have a family history, it will start at age 35. It's this pre-screening, early detection, that's so important for all different types where screening is available, because that is the earliest intervention is always prevention. And if you can detect it early stage, that's the next best thing, you could say. And so early detection saves lives, prevention saves lives. What we're trying to do during all of that is to target these hallmarks and catch them early in terms of tumor growth and the different things that happen at a molecular and cellular level and a tissue level eventually that becomes detectable on imaging.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So just to expand a tiny bit on, you just used the word hallmarks there, and you're referring to the hallmarks of cancer, which maybe not everybody's familiar with. If you just want to briefly say what those are,
okay, so
in general, you know, and how they are important.
So some hallmarks that you can find in yourself has to do, for example, if you have night sweats, if you have unintentional weight loss, you have or unintentional weight gain. Or you have weight gain in terms of fluid, bloating, swelling, also known as edema. You have fatigue that doesn't go away with rest, and other changes perhaps related, but are not considered pathognomic or actually part of a cancer picture. And those could be things like hypertension, insulin resistance, or pre-diabetes or diabetes. Heart disease, also known as, or metabolic syndrome, which is hypertension, high cholesterol, and the insulin resistance piece. All of those are sort of hallmarks of abnormal cell control, inflammation, chronic low-grade inflammation, and attacks on your body, which causes fatigue. And so it's an extra burden cellularly, metabolically, that it's using different fuel sources. It's resisting cell cleanup by the immune system. It's resisting detection by the immune system. There's like 12 cellular hallmarks that are researched in science that become drug targets in pharmacology and in that industry. But in the actual symptoms people present with, that's that list. It's fatigue, unexplained weight loss or weight gain, just generally not feeling well, not feeling like yourself, night sweats, you're not, you know, even if you are in menopause, these night sweats are different, that sort of stuff. It's those things that are the hallmarks that you should be speaking to your doctor about. Mm-hmm. Now when you go to actual cancer diagnosis and you've been given your treatment, like you said at the beginning in your introduction, and now you're told to watch and wait, or there's nothing. This is my favorite. There's nothing you can do. Just go live your life. Right. There's absolutely everything that you can do. It just depends on what you want to choose. And so part of my work with people is to empower them so they don't feel overwhelmed when they see this list, but also to say, hey, some of this stuff you're already doing, some of these things are important, but maybe not as important for your specific cancer and your metabolism, depending on what's going on. Some of these things could be modifiable even before you were working on them, even before you were diagnosed. And so all these modifiable things like weight loss, if you're obese, if your BMI is over 30, that's a known carcinogen. Eating red meat, that's a known carcinogen. You're probably working on or reducing red meat just for the greenhouse gas effect and the effect on the planet. Then there's other things related to adequate rest, night shift, work, those types of sleep-wake circadian disruptions also cause chronic immune suppression, which can lead to cancers. So there's And of course, cigarette smoking and cessation is very important as part of the other, you know, modifiable behaviors that people can pursue in looking at their risk and their family's risk and what their exposure is and deciding, you know, if I've been diagnosed or if I'm at risk of being diagnosed, what can I do? This is what I can do. You know, these are the things that I need to evaluate on my inventory sheet and decide, okay, I can eliminate these things. I can induce these lifestyle changes.
Interesting. Well, so as you point out, there's this incredible list of things, actually resources that are there for to help people avoid a recurrence. It's somewhat in contrast to conventional medicine that's got a few sort of hormone blockers or whatever that people take for a long period. But generally speaking, there aren't a lot of strategies for avoiding recurrence. It's not a strength of conventional medicine. So I think, you know, as I said at the outset, this is one of the great things about integrative medicine is to be, if you can prevent a recurrence, that's massive. You know, it's not a small thing. It's absolutely huge. The other part, you use the word empowering people there with these strategies. And I wonder if we could just talk a little bit about the psychology of going from being a victim of cancer and having things you can actually do to keep yourself well to prevent a recurrence.
This is a big one for anyone who's been diagnosed and their caregivers and family members, because it feels like a violation. It feels like your body has let you down. It feels like you have no control. And those feelings produce a lot of anxiety and fear, which creates a lot more stress hormone and other problems associated with just being able to stay present in the moment. Some of the psychology of a cancer diagnosis could be positive as well, in that it helps people sort what is important from what is not and make those important things priorities so that they, if they're diagnosed early, they can make plans to do something, whatever their stressors are, they can do less of those, incorporate more things related to inducing and creating happiness and joy. One of the things that we know modulates the immune system during times of stress is humor. Mm-hmm. And so being able to watch good comedy or to laugh with family and loved ones is as immune boosting as, you know, IV vitamin C, for example. And so part of it is, it's an important piece that is often unrecognized. And in cancer, usually there are counselors and psychologists who are oncology trained. And I recommend always my patients seek them out, their caregivers seek them out. They don't have to speak to them at the same time. They can certainly go at separate times. They can go together. They can do all of the above to discuss how cancer has come into their lives and what it is and isn't doing. And, you know, where they can keep it sort of at bay or managed so that the emotions that surround cancer don't take over the whole life. I think it's important to understand that you're still a person first when you're diagnosed with cancer. You still have feelings, you still have goals and dreams and things that you want to do. And you can still work towards obtaining those goals and achieving those successes. They may take on different forms. They may take on a different time frame. And there just may be compromises along the way that you make, you know, for example, but they're still possible. It's just a matter of evaluating what is important and deciding with the energy, with the time, with your resources, what's possible and going from there.
So, I mean, it's good to hear that, you know, with something that seems so unremittingly bad as a cancer diagnosis, that there can actually be positives in there as well. So it's not to wish it on anybody, but it's certainly an awful lot of people do report that they've got something very positive from the experience.
Yeah, and there are good days with cancer, just as there are bad days with cancer. And I think that if you, I try to help my patients understand that the perspective of how cancer has been portrayed has been largely negative, and for obvious reasons. But what's happening now is because of better screening, some improved access, we still need to improve our access to screening and equitable healthcare. But because things are improving in general, people are being diagnosed earlier, people are being allowed to live longer as a result. They're not being diagnosed so late. because late diagnoses don't offer a good prognosis at all. Early stage detection, prevention, those are the key hallmarks. And a lot of what naturopathic medicine does is in the preventative side. Mm. And I've worked both spectrums, where I've helped people work on the preventative piece, and I've worked in late stage cancer care in integrative settings, where we are doing a lot to support conventional treatments and reduce side effects and improve quality of life and all of those things. I still do that, but I'm also a big fan of early screening. I still tell my breast cancer patients, when you turn 45, you still need to go get your colonoscopy. Those are checks that you need to get, you know. Mm-hmm. That's part of prevention.
Right. Okay, so I wonder if you could go on to talk a bit now about knowing what to do. There's such a mass of possibilities, even within one area such as nutrition, that knowing what the best choices are for you is an absolutely immense challenge these days. So would you say something about how you navigate this territory?
Yes. So first, when I speak to people about nutrition, I ask them what they think their diet is like, if they feel there's areas they could improve, what the limitations are. Part of it for me is I can go in and provide them with dietary ideas, but they may already have implemented half of them, or they may have allergens that I need to be aware of when I'm talking to them about diet. That all comes through on the intake form, but sometimes it's missed. And so when I talk to them about their dietary intake, I'm listening for what's missing, but also for what's not needed. And we work on tweaking things out. My general guidelines, though, if I was to just pick any type of cancer, let me just go to my list here on the side. I have some notes here. So for dietary recommendations, for everyone except glioblastoma, everybody needs to be on a clean, plant-based, low glycemic diet. So that could be like Mediterranean. That could be like something related to more vegetables than fruits, more low glycemic vegetables than fruits, that sort of thing. The Mediterranean's a good place to start because there's a ton of cookbooks and recipes and apps, and all the resources are there. It's not like you have to start from zero. When I say clean, I'm talking about the Environmental Working Group's Clean 13 list of vegetables that are most low in their pesticide use and herbicide content, that sort of thing. It also gives you an idea of what to avoid or what to find organic if it's not on that list. And for glioblastoma, I list that as an exception because that group does have evidence for favor of ketogenic diet specifically. And it has to do with some of the control on inflammation and seizure control. But for the most part, it's still low glycemic index, while especially on things like dexamethasone or hydrocortisone steroid. If anybody is on that, whether they're pre-treated before chemo with the dexamethasone or hydrocortisone, then they can't really go keto at all because their blood sugar will spike because of the steroid. So low glycemic index is what we aim for, and we work on keto later on. Dietary things like modified fasting and intermittent fasting are very important because, as I said earlier, a lot of people are already pre-diabetic and insulin resistant. And we're seeing more people who are not obese, but who are normal body weight, but still insulin resistant. Mm-hmm. And that is a contributor to the low-grade chronic inflammation, that meta-inflammation that cancer creates. We don't want chronic hyperglycemia. That's just an elevated blood sugar level that is doing nothing to help our body. It's only promoting inflammation. Mm. And inflammation fools the immune system into not seeing cancer cells. And so what we want is to get rid of that high sugar, bring that down to normal levels or low levels using something like a combination, of course, of intermittent fasting. Usually I recommend like a 13-hour fast whereby you stop by 7 p.m. Mm-hmm. and you don't resume until 8, 9 a.m. the following morning. Most people are okay with that.
It's not a big deal, is it?
No, not a big deal. Now, if you can add a 45-minute walk after dinner, even better, especially if you've been diagnosed, because you're just going to bring that down a little bit more, and that will help your overall survival. And so there's research to show that, you know, intermittent fasting, modified fasting, and fasting mimicking all improve overall survival in people who've been diagnosed because it helps regulate that fuel, that glucose. Mm-hmm. And that's an important part.
Okay, so just for somebody who's listening, maybe and just venturing into this territory for the first time, do you want to just do a quick explanation of what low glycemic foods are?
Yes. So low glycemic, if you Google the glycemic index, you will see a list of foods. And I'm not sure how accurate it is now, because this is based on research from, I think, as early as the 1950s. And so you'll have to see if it's been updated through schools of nutrition. Mine I use from the University of Alberta. And so the glycemic index is a rating system of different foods and how fast that food item will spike your blood sugar levels. So for example, a slice of white bread has a glycemic index of 100 because it's a high glycemic food. You want to aim for foods that are, you know, 70 and lower on that rating scale generally. And so one of the low glycemic foods, for example, are pears and blueberries. They don't spike your blood sugar levels. They're in the low range of that index. And it's just a rating system. So the lower you can eat more often those foods, and then your overall blood sugar level will slowly come down. It takes about 2 weeks. Without any other intervention, it takes about 2 weeks. But it's easy to monitor with a blood stick glucometer. You can get those over the counter, I believe, where in the UK. And so you should be able to monitor it yourself if you want, if you're a data person and you like the numbers and to see what your progress is.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So it's good to look at those kind of lists, because it's a bit counterintuitive for many people to think that a slice of white bread as opposed to some nice sweet fruit actually spikes your blood sugar much, much faster.
Yeah, and the reason being behind it is because it's processed. Mm. So if you actually... if you actually had whole wheat, it would be lower. If you had whole wheat bread, if you chose some of the the other types of bread that are more nutty, have more seeds, are just a bit rougher in texture, have more fiber, the glycemic index goes down. So it has to do with the amount of refining something has had. Generally, if it has come out of the ground or off of a tree, that's a whole food. And if you eat it the way that it came, all the better for you. The less refined it is, the better the nutrient value. Mm. So again, I look at glycemic index, but I also say, you know, your glycemic index is important, but the nutrient value, the nutrient dense foods are also important. And so a slice of white bread certainly doesn't have anything compared to nutrient quality that blueberries would in terms of their, the content in an anti-cancer food. You've got it there with the blueberries. Mm. So
one other thing to go back to, you talked about this ranking, if you like, for the fruits and vegetables in terms of how heavily treated they are with pesticides. So overall, you're saying, well, if you've got the money, buy organic. Is that correct?
Correct. But there are fruits and vegetables that are less sprayed that you don't need to buy organic, for example. And so that's the list. Yeah. Mm.
Right. But anyway, unfortunately, organic costs more. Mm-hmm. And for some people, budget is everything.
Yeah.
So it's good to know what to avoid and what to go for.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very helpful.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself from the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchzip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% with the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchzip.co.uk or click our banner on the UK Health Radio website. Discover alcohol freedom with Zero Zilch Zip. Because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, so just looking at this area, I think we've come from a sort of one-size-fits-all mentality. You've already spoken quite a bit about how you approach different kinds of people and the different kinds of things you have to account for. It's becoming increasingly personalized, I think, as time goes on. And in terms of finding out what you should be doing yourself, that makes it trickier still, doesn't it? In terms of have to know yourself, or your practitioner has to know you. And whereas over time, you may become an expert on yourself. Many people do. They become extremely expert on themselves over time. Initially, that's a tough call, isn't it?
Yeah, especially when you're originally diagnosed. Like, your first months of being diagnosed can be overwhelming because you're doing scans and tests and planning treatments, perhaps, and considering second opinions, even maybe third opinions. And everybody's concerned. They want to know what's going on. You may have to take time off work. It's really hard to focus on the mechanisms of cellular control in cancer when all that other stuff is in the forefront. But as you go through treatment and you start changing your diet and you look at exercise as part of your recovery and stress management and weight management and glycemic control, you know, then you build upon it. And this is why I say it can be overwhelming in the beginning, and you start with what you know. And then you build upon that. You use your confidence gained from doing something like changing your diet and watching your blood sugar normalize to tackling something harder, like intermittent fasting for longer periods of time, or, you know, getting down to meditating. I'm a very fidgety meditator, I will admit. I don't do that well, but I can do a walk and a gratitude walk, and I feel similar to how I would feel if I were to meditate. And so everybody's different, and everybody has to find what works for them. I think that, you know, there's Tai Chi, there's different forms of exercise. That's also going to contribute to your overall survival, but it might not be the first thing you employ when you're diagnosed, and that's okay. You know, there's proof that shows exercise before and up to surgery is very important in recovery. It's kind of like training for a race, in a sense, because the stress of surgery on your body is similar to an endurance event. But then there's other pieces of treatment and care for yourself that come into play, like acupuncture, not just stress management, but acupuncture for symptomatic management, whether it be pain control or side effects or just general relaxation, sleep support. Those are all important. And acupuncture has a known treatment record of treating those very well as a modality. There's lots of other things that go along with measuring and making sure that you're doing everything right. But again, it has to come at the pace of when you're ready for it and what you can handle without feeling overwhelmed and disempowered. Sometimes too much information is too much. And, you know, it depends on the person. I always ask my people, you know, if you want me to run specialized tests and I do them frequently and I know that there's a trend changing, then we're going to change your treatment plan. Because we're monitoring metabolism. We're not just monitoring images. Does that make sense? Like, metabolism happens before an image shows a tumor, because the cells have to get to a certain size before they're showing up on an image. But the metabolism has been there for a very much longer time. And so you can measure that metabolism with specialized testing and getting all of that data through labs. And that is something that someone like myself can monitor. Usually your oncologist is not so keen because it's not their fault. They're outside their practice guidelines. They have specific NCCN guidelines that they need to stay within. And with all due respect to the profession, those are the rules they abide by. And we have our guidelines as naturopathic doctors practicing oncology. And one of them is this recurrence surveillance, you know, this task of knowing those pathways and those markers that are involved beyond the symptomatic hallmarks. We're talking of metabolic hallmarks, because we see cancer as a metabolic disease or a disorder of metabolism, not just cells gone wrong, you know, or DNA. There's a whole tumor microenvironment that is working to support itself against your body, in a sense. It's going to work to survive, kind of like the way a virus does. And there are viruses that do cause cancers, but I don't want to mix the two up, in that cancer hijacks our own DNA and our own machinery and our own cellular processes and signaling to support itself. Mm-hmm. And one of those is an altered fuel pathway in the form of glucose and high blood sugar levels.
Right. Okay. And so this thing you talked about with this overwhelm, I think it's sort of the one of the drivers for this is the sort of historically induced panic about cancer, which, as you say, as resources build and people have better prognoses, it's going down a little bit, but it's still pretty much in place that, you know, cancer equals death. And so there's this feeling of, what, you know, if somebody's looking outside the box, they're looking into integrative medicine, they see all this stuff, and there's a feeling like, I have to do all of this now. It's urgent. And actually, you're not saying that. You're saying something a bit different, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm saying you need to understand how your cancer behaves. Because what you might do, thinking that everybody's doing this, I should too, might not apply to what your cancer personality is. And so this is where all of the details come in on labs and pathology. Like if we know different things are upregulated, then we can target those. And that's where targetable drug therapies are coming in as well, instead of the broad-based chemotherapy, cytotoxic chemotherapies that have been used in the past. They're still used today, but now they're adding immunotherapies to those to give greater benefit in terms of, you know, finding a druggable target and working that way. This is something naturopathic medicine and oncology has been doing for a long time.
Right.
And so that's part of the detail of our work. And it takes a long time to learn it. And it takes a long time to stay on top of it because the data comes up and all, you know, there's different forms of research and there's different types of drugs for specific pathways and markers. And then how those drugs are applied to a cytotoxic regimen or on their own can create a different side effect profile. And that's the other half of work that we do is we work to support, perhaps augment what those chemotherapy or conventional side treatments are. But then we also work to reduce the side effects and the inherent immune challenges that come with those.
Mm-hmm. All right. So look, we've just got a little bit of time left and you've mentioned testing a few times. And obviously this is an important aspect. It's not a cheap aspect, unfortunately. Quite often it can be quite an investment. And in fact, you can invest as much as you want to, it seems. But there's definitely strengths to having some level of testing from two points of view, it seems. There's the one you've just mentioned, which is, well, you can actually be more accurate about what you're doing, what you're choosing to do. But then there's the other aspect, which is monitoring whether your strategies are actually working or not, which is immensely important. I mean, you know, maybe that's more important even. So do you just want to say a bit about how they can be used for these two things?
So at your initial diagnosis, when you are diagnosed and say, for example, you have a tumor marker like CEA or CA19-9, whichever it might be, those are colorectal tumors, but you could, you know, 15-3 for breast cancer. You can check different tumor markers before surgery. Usually they check them a couple times because it is known that if your tumor markers are rising rapidly before surgery, surgery is actually contraindicated. That means your cancer is spreading faster and surgery is not going to work. It's in the bloodstream and it's triggering growth factors that surgery will not control. You actually need chemotherapy or some other type of therapy to reduce those tumor markers and get them stable and then perform the surgery. So that's like a common place to start when it comes to information from labs. This is a standard that we all accept. Yes, we don't want to do anything surgery-wise until we know that those tumor markers are not as active. And that's where neoadjuvant chemotherapy has come in. That's the before treatment being surgery, before surgery chemotherapy protocol. Mm-hmm. And you'll see that in breast cancer protocols and different things that way.
Yeah.
So when you have that piece completed, you'll also have other labs, like just a regular standard complete blood count with a white blood cell differential. You'll do a complete metabolic panel. Those are basic labs that are done as part of regular checkups, even with our regular doctor. You may also get a cholesterol panel, a thyroid panel, and an iron panel to make sure that there's no other things going on. That's a pretty thorough conventional oncology lab workup. What that data gives you is the information about how your liver is working, how your pancreas is functioning, if you are hypoglycemic or not, if you are dealing with any thyroid problems, because thyroid dysfunction can contribute. And then there's to the fatigue and different things related to, and so it needs to be ruled out and differentially diagnosed. You just basically need a good screening to make sure that your body isn't dealing with anything else going on. We're working with cancer, perhaps some dysregulation of cholesterol and blood sugar, but that's part of, you could say, cancer's many diseases, and it's part of that, you know, that microenvironment where cancer's changing the environment to suit its needs. And from there, if you were to come and see someone like a naturopathic oncologist or someone who's trained in oncology from a different perspective than conventional, we would be looking at different markers. So I'll pick triple negative breast cancer, for example. Triple negative breast cancer has a known zinc to copper ratio that is out of whack because copper becomes a fuel. And so if you can chelate that copper out using zinc, then, or other therapies, there's other more, you know, sort of invasive therapies, but zinc works just as well. It just depends on what the copper level is. That helps reduce your risk of recurrence. And it's a simple test. You only need to run it once or twice. You know, as you evaluate, you want it to keep going down. And that's generally someone taking zinc every day. It's a very simple, easy intervention that in research shows there's benefit. Others don't have as much research around them, but I'll pick, vitamin D, for example. Vitamin D is a very good thing when it comes to the immune system in terms of immune regulation, gut health, a number of things related to bone density, immune support, and prevention of recurrence in colon cancer. And so checking vitamin D levels is important, but it's not something you need to run all the time. This is something you could ask your oncologist to run and have your insurance cover. Same thing with zinc and copper. You'll do those maybe once every 6 months if you're low. Your vitamin D levels need to be in a high level, higher than what your oncologist would think is normal. So if you get anything back and your oncologist says, oh, you're in the 30s, that's good. It's not actually good for cancer immunotherapy support. You actually want to get it up into about 75 to 90 range. And so that's another one that's usually amenable to having testing done through your insurance. You don't have to pay out of pocket. One of the things we haven't spoken about yet has to do with the gut microbiome. And the gut microbiome is all those good bacteria that are necessary to keep our gut healthy, to help us digest our food and absorb our nutrients. And if we don't have enough of the good bacteria and we're growing more of the bad bacteria, or we have other overgrowth, then that will affect our ability to digest our food, but then it will also affect your chemotherapy efficacy. And so there's research now that shows if you don't have good GI microbiome in place, or you have a coexisting Crohn's or IBS diagnosis, that will affect your overall survival because your chemotherapy won't work as well. And so fixing that is important. And so this is where a team-based approach comes in, and that you want your gastroenterologist to be working, or your whoever is working with you on your gut health, you want them to be also addressing any of these dysbiotic things to optimize your gut microbiome. Mm. So I'm sorry, there's a lot. And so testing, it depends on what type of cancer it is and the lifestyle of the person. But in general, you can really go down the rabbit hole, and it can be, like you said, it could be whatever you can afford for testing. But some tests are more helpful than others. And I think it's important to enlist the help of someone who looks and does testing regularly and understands the results above what the normal, you know, outside of what the normal ranges are, because we're talking about ranges for cancer recurrence prevention, not just, you know, healthy normal ranges.
Every day, yeah. Very interesting. So in summary, you're saying you can get a lot of information from quite standard tests, in fact, if you
Absolutely.
Have the right person looking at them.
Yeah.
I mean, you mentioned how people, you might get a response telling you it's 30 and it's okay. Actually, what happened in this country is you don't get told it's 30, it's okay. You just get told it's okay. And you don't know what that means. And so you have to encourage people to persist and actually say, actually, what's the number? You know, what's the result? Because, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, look, we're out of time. What an amazing chat. Thank you so much, Heidi. Really interesting. And
you're very welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Yeah, you're a mine of resources and inspiration for people. So as you said at the outset, you work with people internationally. Do you want to tell people what's on offer, how they can contact you?
Oh, yes. So while I work here in the UAE, I'm waiting for my license. The UAE licensing process for naturopathic medicine exists. It's in place, and that is in process, but it takes time. And so while I wait for that, I'm just doing telemedicine. My website is www.integrativecancersupport.com. And you can see more about me, read about me, and you can schedule a discovery call. That's free. It's just a short chat. I can tell you more about my practice. I can tell you, answer your questions you may have about what I do and how I would treat or how I would help you. There's a lot that you can get just from looking at the website that give you an idea of how I practice. And then if you decide that you do want to work with me, the intake appointment is a 2-hour discussion of your treatment plan, whereby I do the research on your actual treatment ahead of time. I look at all your documentation and labs, if you've got them, if you can get them. All of that document review is part of the fee, which is $500 US. And then follow-up visits after that are based on a 1-hour consult on an as-needed basis. Mm-hmm. However, I do encourage people who are going through radiation therapy to not wait until it's needed, because radiation often has a bit of a nadir where the side effects really, they really, really spike at about 14 days after radiation therapy finishes. So I usually like to see people at the 5-week mark.
You're a bit late then.
Yeah, not too late, but in time to really say, okay, we need some stronger interventions or whatever might be going on, just to assess. But most everyone else, when I have established patients, you know, we meet maybe once a quarter. It depends on where they're at and how they're doing. Everybody's at a different level in the learning of their cancer and what their body can handle and how they change their lifestyle and the pace at which they go. And so I give them as much information as I can, because I think it's an important piece to have it and then to implement it at the pace that works for you.
Very good. All right. Thanks very much indeed, Heidi.
Thank you, Robin. You have a great day.
And you. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Well, Heidi seems like a great person to have on your team if you're up against a cancer diagnosis. Do look her up at integrativecancersupport.com. Thank you so much for listening today. Please do join me again next week for another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.